All right, so we're going to start out, excuse me, in the class. This is a course in genetics. We probably ought to take a minute and define what I mean by genetics and what we'll actually be studying in here. And by genetics, I'm really talking about biological information and traits. So specifically, biological information that helps cells function, that make organisms look the way that they do, and we refer to those as traits. So how traits are expressed, okay, and how traits are inherited from parents to offspring. All right, and I will apologize now. I've got bad handwriting. I will try my best to write things, but if I get in a hurry, the first thing that goes is my handwriting. If I'm talking to you and writing at the same time, if you can't read what I wrote up there, stop me and ask, and I will rewrite it. But there's an enzyme that we'll talk about later in the semester called ligase. And when I really get going, ligase looks like this. So this is a G, this is an A, this is the only S of the bunch, okay? So don't be shy to say, hey, handwriting, Nichols, come on, all right? So we're going to look at how information is contained within cells, how it's utilized by the cell to keep them healthy, to allow them to grow, to carry out all the functions that they do, on a larger scale, how that translates into entire organisms. How they look, how they function, but then also how that's passed along from one generation to another. So we're giving ourselves a fair amount of latitude here in what we're going to study in genetics. And one of the things that happens, particularly when we are talking about multicellular organisms, I'll tend to be fairly human-centric. When we start going through some of these things, we'll talk some about plants early on. There are a lot of model systems that are used in genetics, but for the most part, people tend to care more about people than they do fruit flies, so I'll tend to use more human examples. But one of the things that we focus on in genetics is how different people are. You don't look exactly like the person sitting next to you. You're probably different height. You probably have different frame builds, different eye colors. There's a lot going on, and we focus on the differences. The vast majority of biochemistry that's going on in your cells, though, is essentially the same. At a DNA level, you share greater than 99.9% identity in DNA with the person sitting next to you. So those differences come along just based on a relatively small number of changes in the DNA. But we tend to focus on the differences. We get so used to seeing other people walking upright with bilateral symmetry and the head on top and the feet on bottom that we even forget that those things come into play. When we talk about developmental biology, hopefully you'll appreciate that it's amazing that out of all of us in this room, nobody has their head on the bottom and the feet on top, that all of that has to be programmed in with biological information as the fetus is developing. So even though everyone's different, by and large, you're much, much more similar than you are different with all the other people in this room. Okay. One of the things, particularly early on, that I'll focus on is how technology has changed the way that we approach genetics. We'll start today, we'll talk about cell division. After that, we'll talk about Mendel. My PhD is in genetics. I'm an outlier. Geneticists love to just talk about how great Mendel is. Mendel was really good for his time, but if you understand genetics the way that Mendel understood genetics, you basically have a fifth grade understanding of genetics. So we're going to whip through Mendel, and we're going to talk about the way that we understand genetics in the 21st century. And that's by and large facilitated by molecular biology and molecular tools that we have. We don't have to look at entire organisms and find these really significant differences, we can actually go in and examine individual molecules and look for much more subtle differences. So if your experience with genetics involves Punnett squares and that's it, then hopefully we'll open your eyes. Sorry, I tend to say we a lot. I'm used to team teaching. I don't have a tapeworm that I'm referring to when I use plural, at least that I know of anyway. But so, sorry, sometimes I just pop into that. I will apologize for that. But it's an old habit from team teaching. But hopefully I'll open your eyes to these new ways to look at genetics. And the class will talk about, you and I will talk about, big fundamental processes early on, and then later in the term, we'll start looking at subdisciplines within genetics. We'll talk about genetics of cancer. We'll talk about developmental genetics. We'll talk about population quantitative genetics. So we'll look at genetics is so broad now that there are fields within that field. When I went to grad school, it was actually kind of unusual to find PhD programs in genetics, and now there are entire departments and schools of genetics that have degree programs in specific subsets of the field. Okay, so mechanisms of inheritance. We're going to focus in here on cell-based life. If you had 197, then you, or an equivalent class, you've heard the mantra that cells are the basic units of life. We're going to focus on things that have cells. Occasionally we'll wander over and talk about something really interesting that viruses do. But the vast majority of time we're going to be talking about the way that cells use information and pass information along. And so we'll just have a little review session about cells. They come in two main flavors, prokaryotes and eukaryotes. I mentioned the other day that I'm a medical microbiologist. In particular, I work on bacteria found in the human respiratory tract, so I tend to have an affinity for bacteria. Bacteria are prokaryotes. Pro means before. Karyote means cell or nucleus, depending on the particular translation that you're reading. So before there were cells that had a nucleus, there were prokaryotes. They were the forerunner to that. So bacteria are all lumped into prokaryotes. Then everything else are eukaryotic cells, eukaryotes. They have a nucleus, and they have intracellular compartments, membrane-bound compartments, in which you can have specialized functions. For the most part, prokaryotes, bacteria, are just an outer membrane that has a bag of cytoplasm, just some biochemical reactions going on. It's all mixed together. Eukaryotes are larger. They have compartments that allow specialized biochemical processes to take place in each one. But they both need to reproduce. So one of the big distinctions between cell-based life and viruses. Cell-based life all reproduces essentially the same way. You've got a parent cell, it replicates its genetic information, and then it splits in two. Okay? And that's true for prokaryotes, it's true for eukaryotes. The specific way in which they do them is slightly different. When we think, or when we talk about examples in here of prokaryotes and eukaryotes, the big thing that I want you to keep in mind is bacteria aren't, you know, dumb and simple and not elegant, and eukaryotes are, well, I'm a eukaryote, that must mean that it's better. They're just two completely different life strategies. Okay? So with prokaryotes, the life strategy, for a bacterium, the life strategy is the individual doesn't matter. Because every 25 minutes, they can make an offspring that two offspring that look exactly like them. And so if you get a few bacterium and you give them a couple days, before you know it, you've got a billion organisms that are all essentially identical. So if all but one of those organisms die, a few days later, that one that survived will repopulate, and you'll have another billion that are just like them. So any one individual doesn't matter. What matters is you've got to keep one or two alive of the population to repopulate if that happens. So as a result, being able to replicate very quickly, having short generation times, is essential for prokaryotes. So what prokaryotes tend to do is they're fast, they're cheap, they're very efficient. They don't want any more moving parts than they have to. They want to be able to crank out a generation every 25 or 30 minutes. And if they don't get things perfect, it doesn't matter because there's a billion just like them waiting to get it right. Okay? Eukaryotes has an entirely different life strategy. So, for example, for you, it takes, to the point, in Illinois, it takes 18 years before you get to the point that legally you can decide to get married and have kids. Biologically, it takes about 13 years to get you to sexual maturity. Right? That's a huge investment biologically of your parents to keep you from running out in streets or, you know, pogo sticking between train trailers like they showed at the Olympics several times. Right? Getting your kid to reproductive maturity and making sure that they have kids, that's the definition of genetic success. Okay? You're basically driven by your DNA to have offspring. So your DNA will be around the next generation and the next generation. And so biologically, you're not successful if you don't have offspring that reproduces. There's a huge investment in eukaryotes, 13 years versus 25 minutes for a bacterium. Okay? So that means a lot of bad stuff can happen in the world of genetics and biochemistry in 13 years. So eukaryotic cells have a lot of checks and balances. They're always looking, oh, is that right? Does this belong here? Is this the right level of expression? Because the individual really matters. When you've got two individuals that are spending a huge chunk of their life expectancy getting their offspring to maturity, that individual matters greatly. So eukaryotes their cells are obsessive with checks and balances and proofreading and making sure that everything is right. Bacteria just phone it in and hope that it's right, and if not, the guy next door will get it right. Okay. So when we talk about genetics, there will be a big difference in how they do things. The processes will be similar, but you'll see prokaryotes will have a lot fewer moving parts. When we talk about gene regulation, prokaryotes will be like a volume up and down, and eukaryotes will be like an equalizer where you've got a lot of things that you can slide up to different levels to find balance. So if nothing else in this class, I want you to appreciate that just two completely different life strategies, both are successful. About half the biomass on the planet is prokaryotic, about half is eukaryotic. So they're both very viable strategies for living organisms. But it's obvious when it's a prokaryote, and we're talking about cell reproduction because you've got a bacterium, and 30 minutes later you've got two bacteria, but you carry out a lot of cell reproduction as well. When you're developing as a fetus, the rate of expansion of cells is really remarkable, but even when you're an adult, as you are now, some of the gentlemen may still be growing for the next year or so, but for the most part, the big changes are over in your life, but you still have cells that are dying off, need to be replaced. You've got cells that are producing daughter cells. And it's important that biological information is being transmitted accurately to that next generation of cells. And then prokaryotes, they don't carry out what's true sexual reproduction. They do engage in an activity that we'll look at later in the semester called conjugation, which is viewed as a pseudo-sexual reproduction. It's kind of like prom night, pseudo-sexual, if you get 20 minutes afterwards or something. But okay. But most of the eukaryotes that we'll talk about engage in sexual reproduction in which the offspring aren't an exact genetic match with the parents. The offspring are, in fact, a combination of approximately 50% of the mother's DNA, 50% of the father's DNA. It's not an even split. The X chromosome, if you're a male, the X chromosome that you got from mom has more genetic information than the Y chromosome you got from dad. And also, you have cell organelles called mitochondria that contain DNA. You get all of your mitochondria from mom. None of the mitochondria in your cells derive from dad. So mom tends to contribute a little bit more DNA than does dad. Okay. So we'll just skim over this since I've already talked about it. But these are unicellular. We think about them being unicellular. Okay. In this class, other than one lecture, we'll focus on them being unicellular. As a bacteriologist, I will let you guys in on the dirty, dirty secret that bacteriologists don't want the rest of the world to know. Everything that we did from past year to about 15 years ago was wrong. The way that we were studying bacteria was entirely wrong. We would take bacteria, put them in liquid broth, put them in incubators that shook the broth, specifically to keep them from clumping up, and then we would study the bacteria. That's not the way that bacteria live in nature, with the exception of a few marine bacteria that like swimming around in the ocean. Bacteria like clumping up and forming structures called biofilms. And we now know that those biofilms, the cells in the biofilm, actually communicate with each other. They carry on different functions within the biofilm. Bacteria, if you give them a chance, will act like a multicellular organism. But don't tell anybody, because we still have about another 20 years to redo all that research until we can let the world know that, nope, but we're on top of it now, so keep giving us grant money. We wasted a century, but now we got some momentum going. All right. So, but we'll tend to think about them being a single cell on their own. Prokaryotic DNA, it's much more simple than when we talk about eukaryotes. The thing that both cells have in common, if we took all the DNA within the cells and just allowed it to be relaxed, the DNA in your cells relaxed would be much larger than the cell it's contained within. Okay? If we just let it go, we take the Spanx off of the DNA and just let it plop down on the couch, DNA is much larger in eukaryotic cells and prokaryotic cells than the cells themselves. But the amount of compaction and other things associated with prokaryotic DNA is not as onerous as when we talk about eukaryotic DNA structure. And there are two types of prokaryotes, eubacteria and archaea. We're not really going to talk about that too much in this class. Okay, eukaryotes, we'll focus a little bit more on the multicellular ones, but yeast is one of the more popular genetic models for humans. Actually, in grad school, I helped a professor set up a new class in molecular genetics, and they used yeast as the organism in the lab. Yeast are eukaryotes. The way in which their chromosomes divide is essentially identical with humans. The way that they carry out converting this biological information into expressed traits is essentially the same as yours. So yeast is a nice model for humans. So many geneticists use yeast. It's also really nice because you come to lab in the morning and it smells like a bakery, so that's not altogether a bad thing. But yeast will be the one example of a unicellular eukaryote that we talk about. The rest of the time we're talking about larger multicellular organisms. And in eukaryotes, one of the characterizing features is a nuclear membrane. The DNA will be surrounded by a membrane within the cell. It's got its own compartment specifically for maintaining the DNA and expressing those biological traits. And in eukaryotes, the DNA is closely associated with a large number of proteins, and it's twisted up and wrapped around things to get it as compact as possible. And that's great for storage, but when we start talking about accessing that information to use it, we have to undo all of those things to relax the DNA in certain parts, certain regions. So get used to the idea of twisting and compacting when we don't need it, and then relaxing and decompressing when we do need it. Yeah, and this stuff I already told you. There's a high rate of replication, so very short generation times in prokaryotes. So the faster a bacterium can replicate, the better able it is to compete. If you're in a population with a large number of bacteria that are just like you, if you can find some mechanism by which you save 10 seconds, okay, you can divide 10 seconds faster than the people around you, 2 weeks later, your progeny are half the population, okay, compared to everybody else. You may have started out one in a million. If you can save 10 seconds a few weeks later, half the population is your progeny. So saving small amounts of time in replication to a bacterium gives them a huge competitive advantage with their brothers and sisters. So we'll see mechanisms by which bacteria kind of cheat to divide faster. And bacteria will tend to have a single chromosome. So when we start talking about pairs of genes and dominant and recessive and homologous pairs, none of that stuff plays in bacterial genetics. Okay. If you just have a single chromosome, if you've got a gene for it, you've got a gene for it. That's the one that you've got. When we talk about eukaryotes, we'll talk about homologous pairs of chromosomes. You get those from that sexual reproduction that we talked about. You get one chromosome one from mom, one chromosome one from dad. And so those are referred to as homologous pairs. And in humans, there are 23 pairs of chromosomes. You get 23 from mom, 23 from dad. Okay. Chromosome structure. Chromosome is, we'll spend a lot of time the next few days talking about chromosomes. That's really the package of DNA that's moved along to allow inheritance. And chromosome structure is much more involved in eukaryotes than it is prokaryotes. Prokaryotes, bacteria just make a circle of DNA, and that's their chromosome. Okay, eukaryotes, they've got linear chromosomes, so straight lines. They've got special structures on the end to stabilize them. They've got special structures in the middle. So chromosome structure itself is more involved in eukaryotes. And again, a big difference is bacteria just want to reproduce as quickly as possible. With eukaryotes, there's something we'll talk about today called the cell cycle. That is, the cell decides, is it an appropriate time for me to divide and have offspring? Bacteria, for the most part, that answer is, oh yeah, it is. Let's just keep dividing. With your cells, it's, do we need more of the cells? Let me kind of look. Let me think about it for a while. And then there are a few checkpoints along the way. Yeah, I think maybe I should divide. And then it commits some resources to it. And then it stops and it assesses later. And that's generally a good thing. When your cells start thinking like prokaryotes, that it's always time for new cells, that's what causes cancer. Just you get an unchecked mass of cells that are always dividing. So that self-assessment of eukaryotic cells, is it time to divide? Is it really? Do we need it? That's a good thing. There's a lot of research going into that because, by and large, we tend to think that cancer thing is not good and everybody would love us to cure it. And so as scientists, we want people off our backs. We would love to go to FARC and not see the meme, still no cure for cancer. So heart disease gets the most funding. AIDS per patient in the U.S. gets the highest amount of funding, but by and large in the U.S., there's the second most funding goes to cancer research. Much of that is looking at that eukaryotic cell division problem. Okay, so said you've got homologous chromosomes. You've got one from mom, one from dad for each pair of chromosome. We refer to those as homologous pairs. And in cells in which you have homologous pairs of chromosome, we call those cells diploid. Marker blues. Diploid cells, another way that we'll denote them is 2N. Just meaning that for each chromosome, they have a pair. They will have a pair of them, one from mom, one from dad. And the vast majority of cells in your body are diploid cells. If I take a cell out of your elbow, it's diploid. Take one out of your liver, it's diploid. Your brain, it's diploid. So the vast majority of your body comprise diploid cells. So sometimes we refer to those as somatic cells. Soma means body. So the cells that make up your body, somatic cells, are 2N or diploid. For each chromosome, there's actually a pair, one from mom, one from dad. Okay. And then there are certain specialized cells that are haploid. We denote them as N, okay, where you no longer have homologous pairs. In those cells, for example, your chromosome 1, chromosome 1 is the largest chromosome in humans. Usually in your somatic cells, you'll have a maternal and a paternal chromosome 1. In the haploid cells, you just have one chromosome 1. And as we'll talk when we talk about meiosis in a bit, sometimes it's from mom, sometimes it's from dad. All bets are off which parent contributes which chromosome and which haploid cell. Okay? And these are generally referred to as germ cells. And in most multicellular eukaryotes, these are involved in reproduction. Okay, so the cells that will become eggs and the cells that will become sperm are haploid. You've got half the genetic information in haploid cell as you do a diploid cell. So I'm really hoping that here in a little bit when we talk about the fusion of an egg and sperm that I'm not the person giving you guys the birds and bees talk, because you're going to be sorely disappointed if I am. There's not a lot of romance involved in it. Alan Katz, one of my colleagues, he teaches this class every other semester. You probably had him in 197. In Alan's world, sexual reproduction, an egg and a sperm never step foot in the same room without the couple being married, when he talks about the story. So a man meets a woman, they get married, they decide to have kids. And then we can start talking about an egg and a sperm getting together. Okay, what you guys don't know is when Alan teaches the non-major genetics class, he tarts it all up for them. And he's telling stories about Catherine the Great making out with horses and all that. For you guys, you need a marriage certificate and clergy involved before eggs and sperm ever get a chance to do this fertilization thing. So I tend not to be that conservative. So, and I think in the real world, occasionally eggs and sperm bump into each other outside of the holy matrimony. So, my sister's really glad that that takes place. So. Okay, so this is what we call a karyotype. We'll see some of those throughout the semester. This is a karyotype of humans. So this is just taking a look at the chromosomes within a cell. And in human genetics, we number the chromosomes from largest to smallest, with the exception of the chromosomes involved in determining gender, the sex chromosomes. The X chromosome is actually about the sixth largest chromosome. But we just go through 1 through 22. And then the sex chromosome down here, and in this case, they're both X chromosomes. So this is the karyotype of a female. We'll talk about that in a few lectures. But you can see in all these cases, there are two chromosomes for each of these. So this comes from a somatic cell, that it's a diploid cell, 2N. Each chromosome is represented by a homologous pair. One came from the mother, one came from the father of this individual. Now, when we start talking about those differences that we notice between everyone in this room and how that's a relatively small part of what's going on, what we'll talk about later in the semester are there were different versions of genes. Genes are really the discrete package of biological information that are present on chromosomes. Okay? And so you can have two different versions of the same gene. You can actually have multiple versions of the same gene. One of the examples that we'll use in here from time to time are coat color and patterning of dogs. there are really only about four or five places in the dog genome that encode how they look on the outside. And there are so many different genes, specific genes that can go into those positions that you can get all these varieties of appearance of dogs. The other thing you'll get sick about is me championing how cool beagles are compared to inferior dogs like poodles. But so we will refer to versions of genes as alleles. And we'll go over this a few times. You'll get this terminology beaten into your skulls. But when you have homologous chromosomes, so we'll say this is chromosome 7. Okay? And there are genes that are present. They will be present at roughly the same position physically on the chromosome. And there are slight differences. So this gene expresses a slightly different set of biological information as this one does. And that's how you can get some of the differences. Mom's got a different allele on her chromosome than dad does. And it's the combination of the variety of alleles that are carried on those homologous chromosomes that affect expression and how your cells behave and how you look. All right, so we'll talk about specific parts of a chromosome. Let's see if we've got a nice picture. And again, we're talking about eukaryotes with linear chromosomes. Remember, prokaryotes have a circular chromosome. You've got linear chromosomes. All right, so if the chromosome is not replicated, if the cell's not ready to divide, chromosomes will exist as just this little linear structure. Okay. When your cells are getting ready to divide, if you're going to make two daughter cells from a parent cell, you need twice the information. You need to replicate your chromosome so that each daughter cell gets a copy of that chromosome. So what happens shortly before cells divide is the chromosomes are will make an exact copy of itself, and they'll stick together. Okay? So it doesn't wander off until we're ready to divide the cells. But it takes a lot of time, a lot of energy to replicate a chromosome. Your chromosome 1 is several hundred million bases in length. It's a really large DNA molecule. Takes a lot of energy and effort to replicate it. You just don't want that partner wandering off. You want to keep it together until the appropriate time to separate them. So this is an example of one chromosome, but it's a replicated chromosome. And when I draw those on the board, this would be an example of the first one. And the second one, I would generally draw it like that. Okay? Each one of these structures is called a chromatid. Okay. When they're held together at one spot, they're chromatids. Okay. And the spot at which they're held together is called the centromere. Okay. Now, if you're ever in doubt, if you count the number of centromeres, you know the number of chromosomes. So right now, when these things are together, they just share one centromere. When we pull them apart, they would each have their own centromere. Even if they're just barely pulled apart, at that point in the terminology, you have two chromosomes. When they're attached like this, you have two chromatids on one replicated chromosome. Okay. Some specialized structures that they have at the ends. Okay, the ends of the chromosome are referred to as telomeres. And telomeres serve a function of being protective of the chromosome. The inside of your cell is still a fairly harsh environment. Molecules get dinged up, and it's really easy to start causing damage to a molecule starting at the end of it. So your chromosomes want to protect the ends. They have these structures called telomeres. We'll talk about them several times throughout the semester. But you can kind of think about telomeres being a little bit like the aglets, the little hard coverings on the end of your shoelaces. It keeps the end of your shoelaces from starting to unravel and fall apart. Once you lose the aglet, your shoestrings' days are numbered, that they get wet and it just starts coming apart. So we're protecting the ends with telomeres. There's a lot of research being put into telomeres because as you age, your telomeres get shorter and shorter, and that affects the expression of some of these genes near the telomeres. Some of the genes near that are in connective tissue. So collagen expression, so you start getting wrinkles because you're not producing enough collagen to fill out around your eyes and along the edges of your mouth. So there are a lot of people looking at trying to come up with ways to keep telomeres at full length like a young person. The problem with that is one of the defenses you have against cancer is the fact that these shorten, and so after a certain length of time, cancer cells can't replicate anymore because the telomeres just keep getting shorter and they wear out, basically. So it's a defense mechanism, but if you want to look great when you're 70, we got to figure that thing out. And my guess is you guys will look better at 70 than I'm going to look at 70. Just science is on your side much more than it's on mine. So until Bill Gates gets really shallow and starts worrying about the way that he looks, but guys have it different in life. You know, if you can write a big check, women overlook the fact that you're not the most attractive guy in Seattle. So, but okay, and then the centromere has a couple functions. It keeps the chromatids together, and it has a specialized part. So this is just a blow-up of the centromere. Certain regions called the kinetochores. And when we start dividing the, kinetochore. When we start dividing these sister chromatids into daughter chromosomes, the kinetochore is basically the handle of the centromere. It's where we're going to grab the chromatids. Right. Yep. Yep. Two chromatids on one chromosome, one replicated chromosome. And this one is an unreplicated chromosome because there's just one chromatid. If there are two chromatids, it's replicated but still just one chromosome. In this case, now we've got two chromosomes. And if we wanted to identify them further, they're unreplicated chromosomes because there's just a single chromatid in them. And so the kinetochore is a specific part of the centromere that we'll use when we pull these guys apart. All right, so now we're going to talk about the cell cycle. And I warned you guys on Tuesday this is going to happen. Show of hands, how many people have never had mitosis and meiosis in a class in either high school or college? All right, so we're going to whip through this stuff. We're not going to spend a week on mitosis and meiosis. I'm assuming that the terminology is familiar to you. We'll go back over it a little bit, talking about the hallmarks of each phase, but we'll see how the rest of the class, if I get diverted and go into story time with Wade, we're screwed. But if I stay on point, we'll get through both mitosis and meiosis today, right? Welcome to college. Sorry. You wouldn't want to pay me as much as you guys are to just go over what you already learned in high school. So, and that's one thing I don't know if I mentioned it the other day about taking advantage of my office hours and things like that. I'm the guy that's writing the exams. Students, and rightfully so, bitch and moan about how much textbooks cost. And then at the end, when you guys evaluate it, you're like, I paid $135 for a textbook and I used it four times. You guys each are paying me quite a bit more than $135 to meet with you on a weekly basis. And by and large, I sit alone during my office hours, sobbing quietly in my office. Oh, what have I done? I wish they would come by and talk cell replication with me. I'm the most expensive resource that you're paying for in this class. Use me. Okay? Swing by and take advantage of me. That sounds better. Okay, thank you. All right. I may have to go back and actually delete that line from the audio file so I don't wind up in court. So, catch me after class. Swing by during office hours. Bounce me emails. I'm a lot more expensive than the book, and the book, the author of the book, is not going to be grading your tests. Okay? So, moving on to cell division at a college level, this is what's happening in eukaryotes. So this is the life cycle of a cell. The vast majority of this time is spent in something called interphase, where that's the point in a life of a cell in which it's not actively dividing. And the vast majority of a healthy cell and a human, it spends the majority of its life in interphase. When you start getting cancer cells, the amount of time that they spend in interphase decreases, and the percentage of time that they spend actually going through mitosis and cell division becomes a much larger percentage of the time that those cells spend. So there are a few within interphase. There are three main stages I want you to know, or sorry, four that I want you to know. G1 is the first one. G, you could think about it being for growth. Okay? So it happens right after a cell divides into two. As soon as you have two separate cells, those cells are in G1. And the cells tend to be a little bit undersized. They don't have everything that they need to be a full-blown cell, so it's their job just to get up to speed, to carry out their function. So it tends to be a time in which there are a lot of proteins being made, there's a lot of carbohydrates being produced by the cell, they require some nutrients, and they're just getting full size and getting up to speed for their function. Okay? And that's what G1's about. And once they get up to speed and they're carrying out that function, most cells in your body will enter this loop called G0. G0 is, I'm big enough, I'm carrying out all the right activities, I don't have to think about my next round of replication. I'm just here, I'm in homeostasis, right? I'm healthy, I'm functioning. My job is just to get things done. If I'm a liver cell, I'm going to detoxify. You know, if I'm, the cell-specific activity is being carried out, it doesn't need to think about replicating, it's in G0. Okay? Then, at a certain point in time, maybe there's been an injury in that area, more cells are needed, maybe it's an organism that's growing. The cell needs to start thinking about replicating. It pops out of this G0 loop, goes back into G1, grows a little bit more, and then it comes to this thing called the G1S checkpoint. And this is one of those steps that I was talking about in which eukaryotic cells self-assess. Do we really want two of me? Right? I'm doing fine. I've been in G0. I've been taking care of business. Do we really need someone just like me right beside me? Okay? And at that point, there are certain cell signals that will let the cell know, look, we're stressed around here. We need more hands to get this job done. And it will pass through the G1S checkpoint. Okay? It will pop out of G1 and progress to the next stage called S. So now that G1S checkpoint terminology makes sense. It's the checkpoint between the G1 phase and the S phase of interphase. The cell is still not actively dividing at this point. We're still in the part of the cell cycle in which we consider the cell not dividing. Okay, S stands for synthesis. Okay, and what we're synthesizing primarily is DNA. This is the point at which the unreplicated chromosome becomes a replicated chromosome. And when we talk about replication, the molecular mechanism of replication later in the semester, this is when it's taking place, is during the S phase. But that checkpoint is really important because it takes a huge amount of energy and effort to replicate big chromosomes. So cells have to be efficient. Cells that aren't efficient don't stay in business very long. And you don't want to just replicate your chromosomes if you're not getting ready to divide. So in S, a lot of investment of energy to replicate that chromosome. So we go from this to that. Then after the DNA has been replicated, we've got replicated chromosomes, the cell enters the G2, And the G2 phase is basically the cell coming home after a hard day of replicating its chromosome and putting its feet up on the footstool and kicking back and watching TV and not getting anything accomplished for that evening. You just have days where you have busted your butt from the time that you woke up until you get home and you don't feel like doing a damn thing the rest of the day. Your cells are like that. After synthesis phase, they just want to recompose themselves. And that's what G2 is about. They sort of get some more nutrients, they catch up, because they've just gone through a very exhausting process. Okay? And there's not a checkpoint in here. Once you're done replicating your DNA, you've earned that vacation. If you're a cell, you get to enter G2 directly. Then at the end of G2, there's a second checkpoint, the G2M checkpoint. M stands for mitosis. And mitosis is the separation of chromosomes. And cell division is separate. Cell division encompasses mitosis and also the separation of the cytoplasm and organelles. So when we talk about mitosis, we're just specifically talking about making sure that each daughter cell gets the same amount of genetic information. If you want to talk about the organelles, you need to take cell biology. We're going to focus on the chromosomes in here. Yes? It depends on the cell. In labs, one of the things that we do in labs is we look at the cells at the tip of an onion root, because roots tend to be, especially in a young plant, are expanding and they're growing. And so the cells at the tip of that root are replicating very quickly. But even then, 70% of the cells at a very fast-growing tissue, healthy tissue, will be an interphase. In a eukaryote, in a fast dividing cell types, you can look at replication times of like 12 hours, 14 hours. Humans, it's most cell types, most human cells spend a significant amount of time in G0. So it's highly variable depending on what you're doing or which cell types. Then if the cell goes through all these checks and it's assessing the situation, if it still needs to replicate, then it will go through this checkpoint. If conditions have changed and it's no longer needed to replicate, the cell can stop at this point. It will have replicated chromosomes. It'll be a little honked off because it just spent all that energy replicating and now it's being told not to divide. But you can stop a cell at this point. Okay. But if it gets all the environmental signals that, yep, we need two of you instead of one, it will go ahead and enter mitosis. And there's a checkpoint that we'll talk about here called the spindle assembly checkpoint. You don't have to memorize that specific terminology, but it tends to take place in a specific phase of mitosis. All right, so the two main stages then of cell division, mitosis, where we're separating the sister chromatids into daughter chromosomes, and cytokinesis is the separation of the cytoplasm. Cyto means cell, and kinesis means activity or movement. So we're moving the cell from one into two in cytokinesis. Okay. So mitosis is broken down into five phases. I will go on record right now. I'm not a big fan of prometaphase. I think it's an arbitrary one that was made up just because it's easier to see what's going on in prometaphase than it was in prophase. But it's just a crutch that geneticists with bad eyesight have used to make students learn one more thing. When in doubt, if you're taking the exam, don't guess prometaphase because I don't love it and I'm not going to showcase it on the exam for the most part. All right, so let's go straight to the big picture. So interphase is the one that we've been talking about where nothing's happening. It's not actively replicating. We've got here a diagram of a cell, and this is an actual fluorescent micrograph of what's going on in the cell. This blue area is the nucleus of the cell. Out here, the red and orange area is the rest of the cell, the cytoplasm or cytosol of the cell. Cytosol is the space. Cytoplasm is the material that's inside of that space. But we're going to be focusing a lot on what's going on in the nucleus, and you don't really see much in interphase. It's because the DNA's kind of relaxed. The chromosomes are much more relaxed now than they will be later. DNA is this long, straight molecule. You can think about it being like a lot of yarn, and it's sort of just interacting with each other, intertwining at this point. One of the first things that has to happen in this process is we want those chromosomes to condense. We want them to be much shorter so we could reach out and grab them. We don't want to reach in and grab a bunch of yarn or a bunch of spaghetti, right? We want something that's smaller, discrete. It's easier to separate them out. And so it's really tough to see these individual chromosomes during interphase. The first stage then in mitosis is called prophase. And prophase, there are a few hallmarks that we see the DNA going from this really long, stringy structure to discrete linear chromosomes. And you notice now that it's replicated. They were replicated during the S part of interphase. So when they do condense, they're replicated. And the other thing that happens, there are structures called centrosomes. When you had 197 or the equivalent class, you learned that centrosomes help coordinate microtubule production, and they exist as perpendicular pairs of centrioles is the centrosome. The way that we're going to move chromosomes around is pushing and pulling them with microtubules. So we want centrosomes, centrioles, to coordinate the production of microtubules to connect with the chromosomes. And what happens is the centrosomes start moving to opposite sides of the cell. And the way they do that is by expressing microtubules. And it's sort of like a spider doing push-ups on a mirror, that from the centrosomes they'll produce microtubules that will go out, and the microtubules will connect and push each other away. As the microtubules get longer and longer, they'll push the centrosomes further and further apart. And so they wind up moving to opposite sides of the cell. Okay. The other thing that happens is the nuclear membrane will start to thin out at this point. It's still present, but if you're really observant, you can notice that the nuclear membrane is starting to thin. Okay. Then we move into prometaphase. In prometaphase, what they're saying has happened is the centrosomes have reached the opposite ends of the cells. The centrosomes are at the opposite ends, and the nuclear membrane has disintegrated at this point. Okay, it's just a continuation of what was happening in prophase. But now in our diagram here, they've got a really excessive example of difference between prophase and prometaphase. You can see the chromosomes are somewhat linear here, and here they're really thick and dense. Okay. Then we go to metaphase over here. Meta means middle. And what happens in metaphase, the chromosomes get pushed to the middle of the cell. And the way that that happens is these microtubules, we call them mitotic spindles during mitosis, but they're microtubules, that they're being produced by these centrosomes. They bind to the chromosome at the kinetochore. So we said the kinetochore was the handle of the cell or of the centrosome. So what happens is the microtubules bind to the kinetochore. And they can be bound by multiple microtubules. Okay? But since the centrosomes have moved to opposite ends of the cell, they're going to be bound from either one direction or the other. They're not going to be bound by something up here or something slightly off to the side. It's either going to be from the left side or the right side of the textbook. People rarely draw mitosis happening up and down. It's almost always left and right in textbooks. And so we're going to bind this thing from both sides. And then in a few minutes, we're going to pull apart. Okay? So what happens, though, first is it's bound and the microtubule is still lengthening. And so the microtubules on both sides will lengthen until at about the middle, the microtubules are exerting the same effort or the same force on the chromosome, and they're lined up in the center part of the cell. So here we've got all of these chromosomes, replicated chromosomes, lined up, and they're attached to these spindles, the microtubules. That's metaphase. Meta means middle. The hallmark of that is all the chromosomes are lined up in the middle. In this fluorescent micrograph, the chromosomes are blue. The mitotic spindles are stained green in this picture. So if you see all these little green lines coming out, there are also some that go the opposite direction. The centrosomes, since they're exerting so much effort, they need to be anchored to something. So they make some spindles behind them to interact with the cytoskeleton of the cell so that they're anchored in place when they're moving these things around.
Yep. The green
things
are
the microtubules? Yep. I'm sorry? The microtubules bind to the kinetochores. Yep. And so then we move to from metaphase to anaphase. Ana means away from. So we are moving away from the middle. We're moving the sister chromatids away from each other. And so what happens in anaphase is the chromosomes get pulled away, and they get pulled away quickly enough that it sort of bends the chromosome at where the centromere was. So instead of looking like a straight structure now, they tend to look like Vs. And it would be, if I walked up behind you in a cartoon and grabbed you by your belt really quickly and yanked, in the cartoon world, your feet and your hands would both go out at an angle, and you would be in the air, and I'm pulling you back towards me. That's actually what happens with the chromosome. We're moving them by the centromere, so the telomeres at each end are getting pulled. There's a little bit more resistance. They're moving slower. So the chromosomes look like a flying V at this point. Okay. Now, in terms of mechanism, this was not understood, how these things are moving around. It's due to the shortening of the microtubules. So at anaphase, this is that checkpoint that happens in mitosis. When each kinetochore is bound by at least one microtubule from each direction, that's that checkpoint. And until each kinetochore is bound by a microtubule from each side, it won't proceed to the end of mitosis. So anaphase doesn't happen until each one of those kinetochores gets bound from each side. Okay. Then once that happens, there's a molecular signal that's sent. It's like, okay, it's time to start moving these things apart. And then the question, it happens by shortening those microtubules that we've been lengthening this whole time. And the question for a long time was, how do they shorten? Do they shorten? From which end do they shorten? We've got these things out here attached to the centrosomes. The centrosomes could basically be reeling them in, or are they being shortened at the kinetochore? And what scientists found through their research was the kinetochore is just not a binding site. What also happens is there are enzymes at the kinetochore that break down the microtubules, and there are molecular motors, molecules that, if you give them ATP, will move relative to other molecules. There are molecular motors in the kinetochore that will walk along a microtubule. So what happens is it's not the centrosomes reeling in the chromosomes to their side of the cell. It's the chromosome saying, all right, we just passed that checkpoint. I need to start moving away from my sister chromatid. And the kinetochore basically goes all Pac-Man. It just starts moving along and chewing away the microtubule and pulling the two sister chromatids apart. Okay? So it's the chromosome that initiates that at the kinetochore. It's not the centrosomes that initiate anaphase. So this will continue, and you can see here we've got all these chromosomes being pulled apart closer to the centrosomes. Then we enter telophase. Telo means distant. So now we've pulled the chromosomes to the opposite ends of the cell. And at this point, there are some things going on in cytokinesis that we also notice that the spindles release from the kinetochore. And we start to get a formation of a nuclear membrane around the chromosomes at this point. And depending on what type of a cell you are, a plant cell or an animal cell, you start to see a division of the cells. So in here, you can see this kind of faint line that's showing up here that these cells are actually starting to be divided into two separate cells. Okay. So in order, again, we're going prophase, prometaphase, metaphase, anaphase, and telophase. And that's mitosis. We've gone from replicated chromosomes in one cell to now we have two daughter cells that each have the same genetic information but in an unreplicated form. Okay. Yeah, most of this we've talked about, but maintaining that genetic information from parent cells to daughter cells is essential. But the other thing is, with cytokinesis, you like a situation in which each cell gets roughly half of the cell content as well. You don't want one cell to get all the good stuff and the other one not to get much, because then it's at a disadvantage. And so during this process, you would it's best case scenario to have two roughly equally prepared daughter cells that come out of it with the same genetic information. All right. We're not going to have time to get through all of this today, but we'll get started on it. And that is sexual reproduction and genetic variation. And the part that we'll talk about, get started on today, is meiosis. And I'm sorry, I'm old, but I'm not old enough to be the guy that screwed students over by having mitosis and meiosis sound so much alike. That was a bad idea, whoever thought of it. And we ought to change the name. Just everybody get together and just say, we're going to ignore this, we're going to call it Chuck and Debbie from now on, or something like that. So when you're taking the test, it doesn't come down to, oh man, it starts with an M, ends in osis. All right, so we're going to talk about meiosis. In mitosis, we start with one diploid cell, and we end up with two diploid cells. Right? We've just made one cell that's in your elbow and converted, or wound up with two cells with exactly the same genetic information. In meiosis, we're going from diploid cell to producing a haploid cell. And we'll actually produce multiple haploid cells. So this is how your body produces eggs or sperm. This is how pollen is produced in plants. Yep.
One haploid cell?
Nope, we'll actually produce four. But when we start talking about the way that eggs are produced, at the end of this, you would have, if you're a male, you would have four functional sperm cells. If you're a female, you really only have one good egg. But you would have, you would produce four haploid cells during the process. Okay. I'm sorry? One dip in meiosis, we go from one diploid cell to four haploid cells. Yep. And then after you make those gametes, gametes are the haploid cells involved in sexual reproduction. After you make those, we'll actually let them meet in a room and fertilize and make another human. But right now we're just going to focus on meiosis. The names of the phases of meiosis are the same as they are in mitosis. In many cases, the same thing is going on, except we break meiosis down into two stages, cleverly called meiosis 1 and meiosis 2, but always with Roman numerals. This stuff is important. You can tell something's important. It gets Roman numerals instead of the Arabic numbers. Super Bowls and meiosis, they get Roman numerals. All right. So, meiosis 1 We'll spend most of our time talking about meiosis one because that's where the cool stuff happens. Meiosis two, pretty much like mitosis, and you know that already. We just spent 20 minutes going over mitosis. In your notes, you can put meiosis two, pretty much like mitosis. Okay? But the actual reduction from 2N to 1N happens in meiosis one. Okay? So what did we do in mitosis? We separated replicated chromosomes with sister chromatids. We pulled them apart. We did nothing with the homologous chromosomes. Each one of those daughter cells in mitosis still had homologous chromosomes. It's still 2N. In meiosis, to get from 2N to 1N, we have to separate the homologous chromosomes. We've got to separate mom's chromosome 1 from dad's chromosome 1 in your cell. And that takes place during meiosis 1. Right? So, we're just going to talk about prophase. I don't want you to worry about what's going on in early, middle, and late prophase. We're just talking about prophase. Prophase, again, we see the chromosomes condensing so that they become discrete units. Okay? But something special happens in meiosis one, and that is the homologous chromosomes will line up with each other. Okay? So here's chromosome one, here's chromosome two. In these cells, they only have two chromosomes. Okay, this would happen 23 times in your cells. Mom's will make mom red and dad blue. Mom's chromosome 1 lines up with dad's chromosome 1. Mom's chromosome 2 lines up with dad's chromosome 2. Okay. And each one of them is replicated. Right? There are two chromatids for each of these chromosomes. Okay. And this alignment or pairing up of homologous chromosomes only happens in your cells during prophase of meiosis 1. And since you've got four chromatids on those two chromosomes, it's referred to as tetrad formation. Oh, that's the bad. Okay, if you haven't had me in class before and you are a biology ed instructor, probably the most important thing that you will learn from me is, if you've got a board that you're using in a classroom when it comes time to erase, always up and down. Because if you do this, you get this duck action going on with your backside, and you lose all authority in the class. So always up and down. Unless you're Dr. Hitchcock and you can write and erase at the same time and keep clenched and still move at the speed of sound. So. Okay, so tetrad formation. Two chromosomes, two homologous chromosomes. Okay, and they're replicated, which means four chromatids are lined up. Okay. And so what we see here is those four chromatids lined up. When we start talking about genetic variation, let's go to the next slide, and they've got late prophase. What happens is when these tetrads form and you get the chromatids lined up, most of the DNA is identical between mom's DNA and dad's DNA, but there are points at which there is some variation. We had that picture with allele capital A, allele small case A, where mom and dad had two different versions of the genes. There are some differences, but for the most part, the DNA is identical. And that allows them to line up. But what will happen during late prophase is there will be breaks in the chromatids between mom's chromosomes and dad's. And this is where recombination takes place. So these are referred to as chiasmata. Chi is just the Greek letter that looks like an X. We'll refer to it as crossing over or recombination. Part of mom's chromosome gets on dad's chromosome. Part of dad's moves over to mom. You guys are probably all too young to remember the old Reese's commercials. Somebody walking down the street with a Hershey's bar, somebody walking down the street for some unknown reason with an open jar of peanut butter, and they would run into each other. Hey, you got your peanut butter on my chocolate. You got your chocolate in my peanut butter. And this is great. We should invent a candy bar like this. That's what happens at prophase and meiosis one, crossing over. Dad's peanut butter gets all over mom's chocolate. And you may not want that mental image for the rest of the day. I apologize for that. But all right, we will stop there, and then I'll pick up with meiosis on Tuesday. Have a good weekend.